We'd like to have first speaker, Professor David van der Zwak. I'd like to introduce a little bit about his biography. Professor David van der Zwak holds the Canada Research Chair in Ocean Law and Governance at the Marine Environmental Law Institute, Dalhousie University, Halifax, Canada. And he teaches in the area of international environmental law and law of the sea. And Professor van der Zwak is a member of the IUCN's Commission on Environmental Law and co-chair of the Commission of Environmental Law Special List Group on Oceans, Coast, and Coastal Reefs, and a member of the International Council on Environmental Law. And also, he worked for Arctic Council Working Group. So let us have Professor van der Zwak's talk.
Good morning, and welcome to everyone who got up early to actually make it after the galley event last night. My topic is ocean dumping in the Antarctic. And when you look at that topic, two nautical images, I think, help capture where we are in the governance of that activity, potentially applying to the Antarctic. One is tangled legal currents. If you look at the complex mix of international agreements out there, it is very tangled. And I'm not going to get into all the nuances and all the boring details, but I will just flag to you the five major global agreements have impacts potentially on ocean dumping. The 82 Law of the Sea Convention, you have the mainstreams, a couple key conventions dealing with ocean dumping. You get some side currents, I call it, like the Convention on Biological Diversity and also the Basel Convention and Transboundary Movement of Hazardous Waste. And then you get regional gyres, as we've looked at already, the Antarctic Treaty and the Madrid Protocol. So it's quite complex and tangled. The second image I want to just quickly highlight is the Sea of Challenges. It's quite rough out there, getting a really firm grip on ocean dumping. And an array of challenges surrounds the governance of ocean dumping, and I'm going to focus on really three very quickly: ensuring full adoption of international agreements, getting a firm international grip on ocean fertilization projects, a major challenge for the Southern Ocean, and then securing compliance. I don't have time to get into all the other challenges, including enforcement and a question, for example, what is the boundaries between ocean dumping and what's allowed under the International Shipping Convention, Prevention of Pollution from Ships, MARPOL, when it has Annex 5 and it deals with garbage. What's that interface? I don't have time to get into that. Maybe in our discussion we can if there's time. So a two-part cruise will follow. And let me warn you, this is not a leisurely cruise. It's going to be a Zodiac kind of tour, very quick, very fast. I suggest you don't blink because you'll probably miss a PowerPoint. I may set a record for the Smithsonian and maybe for America on the fastness of my PowerPoint presentation. And a particular focus I want to take on the challenges is raised by the proposed ocean fertilization experiments in the Southern Ocean. Does ocean fertilization constitute dumping? What international law and policy responses have occurred to date? And what can be learned from a recent ocean fertilization experiment in the Atlantic sector of the Southern Ocean, the Hoffex experiment by the Polar Stern from the Alfred Wegener Institute just back earlier this year, which raises some interesting questions of control. Okay, tangled legal currents, the five global agreements, the major undercurrent, if you will, the foundation for controlling ocean dumping and other activities is the Law of the Sea Convention of 1982. It sets out various general obligations for countries to protect the marine environment, preserve the marine environment, the duty to minimize the release of toxic, harmful, noxious substances into the marine environment, and it provides for a generic, very kind of weak environmental impact assessment requirement. All states, when they have activities, including ocean disposal activities, are proposed, they really subject them to national EIA review. And there's some reporting requirements, quite weak again, that they should make those publicly available, for example. That does have a particular article on ocean dumping. Article 210 requires states to adopt national ocean dumping laws, no less effective than global rules and standards. It urges states to establish global and regional standards for controlling pollution by dumping, and it mandates the express prior consent of the coastal state for any dumping within national zones of jurisdiction. And herein lies, again, a major challenge for the Antarctic, because when you have the Antarctic with claimant states, having not their claims being recognized by other states, you have this kind of potential problem. Well, who has the control of ocean dumping? It will largely fall in the Antarctic under flag states, the one who have the flag on the vessel to control the ocean dumping from without the region. Two mainstream agreements, if you will. The London Convention 1972 on ocean dumping represents a permissive approach to ocean dumping. Under that agreement, almost anything can be dumped at sea, but you have to get a permit from a government, a state party government, essentially, to keep it real simple. And under Annex 3, they have all kinds of factors that the countries are consider if they're going to allow a permit to a particular disposer. And, for example, you know, what's the toxicity? What's the persistence? Does it take a lot of oxygen from the marine environment? Characteristics of the dumping site, distance from the coast, dispersal potentialities, possible effects on marine living resources, possible effects on fisheries. All these factors come into account whether it should be permitted. You do get a special permits, kind of another category, allow for what they call Annex 2 waste listed on the gray list. These are heavy metals, mainly arsenic, chromium, copper. When you have these kind of waste, again, countries can have a special permit they issue to take special care, essentially, if these are dumped into the ocean. And then you get the kind of a third kind of category of listing is prohibited list. This is the nasty list that all countries around the globe, parties to the convention agree, are not going to allow to be permitted generally at all. Things like organohalogen compounds, some of the pesticides, mercury and mercury compounds, crude oil and its waste, persistent plastics, radioactive waste, chemical warfare materials, and incineration at sea of industrial waste, and industrial waste as of from 1 January 1996. So that's the global prohibited list. We have a 1996 protocol, an additional agreement. When parties jump aboard this agreement, the other one falls away. So this is more of the modernized protocol. And it really takes a precautionary approach, much more preventative approach. And you'll see that in this long Article 3. I won't read it because of time, but take my word for it. It's precautionary approach is fundamental to the agreement. And the key under this document is reverse listing approach, where listing favors the environment and is precautionary. Nothing can be dumped unless it is listed on a global safe list. And then you get a pretty limited safe list that we've accepted globally now that countries consider for dumping dredge material, sewage sludge, fish waste, vessels and platforms, organic materials of natural origin, inorganic geologic material, the big bulky items made of kind of iron and steel, for example, and sequestration of carbon dioxide. Again, you know, the idea we can pump it maybe under the seabed, probably more adjacent to coast largely. That was added actually in November 2006 and enforced in February 2007. Just before, again, when you look at what's actually going on, about 80% or 90% of the ocean dumping around the globe is dredge materials, cleaning out port areas, make them deep, that kind of thing. So most of the dumping is of that type. Even for waste on the safe list, Annex 2 of the protocol further encourages a precautionary approach for permitting process. It basically says government should require the proposed disposer to come forward with a waste audit and say, you know, have you looked at all the alternatives, reuse and recycling, all those things? And the key here is permitting authorities obligated. They must refuse issuing a permit if appropriate opportunities exist to reuse, recycle, or treat the waste without undue risk to human health or the environment or disproportionate costs. So it really is a burden of proof on government to make sure that they don't give the permit if it looks like there's recycling available. Very quickly, the side currents. You have the Convention on Biological Diversity. It restates the well-known kind of what you might call the no-harm principle. States have the responsibility to ensure that activities within their jurisdiction or control, including ocean dumping proposals, do not cause damage to the environment of other states or areas beyond the limits of national jurisdiction. It has become an important side venue, I'd call it, for dealing issues related to ocean dumping, particularly on ocean fertilization. They have a major scientific synthesis of all the things that have been written on ocean fertilization and its impacts. I think that's still in draft form. And they just last week had a major meeting of experts on scientific and technical guidance on environmental impact assessment in marine areas beyond national jurisdiction. And there will be a report coming out soon on that. So again, it's very relevant potentially to ocean disposals, particularly on the high seas. The Basel Convention is really important because it prohibits the export of hazardous waste for disposal within any area south of 60 degrees south latitude. And it leaves implementation, of course, of the prohibition to each party through national legislation. There's one thing that's really cut off the dumping to the Antarctic is probably that, because a lot of what people want to bring down is probably going to be hazardous kind of waste. And then you very quickly get into the regional gyres, I call them. The Antarctic Treaty, it prohibits radioactive waste disposal in the area south of 60, of course, and it does require notice to contracting parties of all proposed expeditions to and within Antarctica on the part of ships or nationals. Again, assuming that would include OSHA proposals to dump out there. And then, of course, you get the Madrid Protocol on Environmental Protection. And it contains three main legal entities relevant to ocean disposal. Annex 3 specifically addresses waste generated in the Antarctic. So get this, waste generated in the Antarctic, not waste coming into the Antarctic from outside. So it's very limited and focused on what it's trying to address. And it has four main ways of dealing with that, minimization, removal, and disposal planning requirements. It urges minimization of waste. So the best way to keep waste out of the environment is just don't produce it. So that's one. It requires removal of many generated wastes. Generators of many wastes produced after entry in force of the protocol must remove them from the Antarctic Treaty area. And I give you an example. I can't get into all of them, but radioactive materials, electrical batteries, waste fuels, waste with heavy metals, acutely toxic compounds, various products that could produce harmful emissions of incinerators, such as rubber, treated timbers, polyvinyl chloride materials, plastic waste, fuel drums, again, generally required to be removed from the region. Here's a picture of Australia waste from Casey Station back in the early 2000s, where it's been ready to be removed. So they actually try to clean up one of the sites and remove the waste from the region. And just as an aside, by the way, Annex 3 actually calls for cleanup of previous waste disposal sites on land. And very surprisingly, it doesn't say about the marine environment. So we probably have historic dumping areas out there yet where you don't really have a removal or cleanup kind of requirement. It imposes disposal obligations. Incineration is encouraged for a lot of the waste that's not toxic and going to have major problems. Solid residues of incineration must be removed from the treaty area. And then very importantly, it does allow some sea disposals of sewage and domestic liquid waste subject to various conditions, taking into account the assimilative capacity, locating discharge where rapid dispersal occurs, and treating large quantities of waste generated in stations have an average weekly occupancy over the Australia summer of approximately 30 individuals or more, at least by maceration, kind of liquefaction of the waste. So, you know, relatively limited kind of requirements on the liquid dumping of sewage and domestic waste. It mandates parties carrying out activities in the Antarctic, of course, to prepare waste management plans. I won't get into the detail of that, but waste management plans are required and to, again, to be reviewed by the Committee for Environmental Protection. There are also, of course, environmental impact assessments. Because of time, I won't get into that, but again, it may apply to proposed disposals, removals from the Antarctic. So again, you have the three levels of environmental impact assessment we've already looked at over the last couple of days on various occasions. A sea of challenges. Ensuring full adoption and implementation of key international agreements. There are only 86 parties to the London Convention, the London Dumping Convention of 1972 as of October 2009, 67% of the world tonnage. And perhaps a more concern, only 37 parties to the modernized protocol, 32.22% of the world tonnage. What that means is a good number of countries are not party at all. And about, you know, almost two-thirds of the world tonnage is not subject to the precautionary approach that we've seen under the protocol. And just to give you a map of that, the countries in red are not party to either the London Convention, the outdated one, if you will, and the more modernized one. And you see a lot of those countries being in Africa, in South Asia, and in Southeast Asia. For example, Singapore, Vietnam are not party to either of the global dumping conventions. And, of course, we've already looked at the problem of limited parties to the Antarctic Treaty and Madrid Protocol, 47 parties, of course, to the Antarctic Treaty, and 34 parties to the Madrid Protocol. So, again, limited adoption. The other major challenge, which I'll focus on in my last minutes here, is getting a firm international legal grip on ocean fertilization projects. And this involves the international control of proposed ocean fertilization projects, exemplified by adding iron to increase phytoplankton blooms and the fixation of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. And I think that whole area might be described as very slippery, with three slippery aspects: controversy over application of ocean dumping regime to ocean fertilization projects, considerable fragmentation on certain international responses to date, And I want to give the example of limited international grip exemplified by this 2009 experiment, the Hafex experiment, in the Atlantic sector of the Southern Ocean. There's been great controversy over application ocean dumping regime and basically different national views. UK did a great study, a questionnaire to countries under the IMO, and you come out with all kinds of different views. Here's the definition of ocean dumping: any deliberate disposal into the sea of waste or other matter from vessels, aircraft, platforms, or other man-made structures of the sea. Some countries say, yes, it is ocean dumping. Adding iron does constitute dumping as iron matter is deposited deliberately and is abandoned. And, of course, you get the no views that iron, while deliberate, is not undertaken for disposal purposes, but for constructive purposes such as marine scientific research. So you have contrary views. Different perspectives on whether ocean fertilization projects might fall under the major exception found in both the London Convention 1972 and the 1996 Protocol. Dumping does not include placement of matter for a purpose other than the mere disposal thereof, provided that such placement is not contrary to the aims of this convention or protocol. There's disagreement over whether ocean fertilizations are placements. Canada, for example, raises the question, well, placement could have a restricted meaning of placing with the ability to retrieve. You throw iron in the ocean, you aren't going to retrieve it. And then there's a lack of clarity over what placements would be contrary to the aims of the convention. And even if ocean fertilization is subject to the ocean dumping regime, questions of exactly how it fits under the permitting process also come up under the London Convention, for example. Could it be an industrial waste listed in Annex 1 and thus prohibited from disposal at sea? Under the 1996 protocol, is iron an inert inorganic geologic material that is allowed to be dumped? And I think most people, certainly scientists, say no. The whole idea is to have chemistry and biological changes out there. So it's not inert, you see. So all these interpretation questions come up. The second slippery aspect, very quickly, considerable fragmentation, uncertainties, and international responses to ocean fertilization proposals to date. You get a fragmented array of international bodies, institutions offering statements, pronouncements, declarations, Convention on Biological Diversity, you get the IMO Convention, meeting of parties, the International Intergovernmental Oceanographic Commission, Ad Hoc Conflict Group on Ocean Fertilization, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Even the UN General Assembly has had a number of assembly resolutions dealing with ocean fertilization. So very, very fragmented. That's one of the problems you run into. And then I just want to pick up very quickly the major uncertainties left in the wake of two of the most important international pronouncements processes. The CBD in 2009, their Conference of the Parties came up with a decision on biodiversity and climate change. It addressed the whole question of ocean fertilization. And they said here, until there's adequate scientific basis to justify such activities, they should not take place until there's a global, transparent, effective control regulatory mechanism. But they provide an exception for small-scale scientific research studies within coastal waters. So they say such studies should be subject to prior risk assessment and strictly controlled and not be used for generating, selling carbon offsets. And, of course, there the big question comes, well, what's small-scale and exactly what are coastal waters? So great uncertainty from the CB when they kind of gave some guidance. And then you get the IMO very quickly. They had a number of things they've done, a statement of concern by the scientific groups, taking the view that knowledge about the effectiveness of the potential environmental impacts of ocean fertilization currently was insufficient to justify large-scale operations endorsed by the contracting parties as well. It's unclear, of course, what does large-scale actually mean. There's actually a resolution by the governing bodies of the London Convention Protocol on Ocean Fertilization. They agree that in order to provide for legitimate scientific research, such research should be regarded as placement for the matter of a purpose other than mere disposal of. And they agree that the scientific research proposal should be assessed on a case-by-case basis using an assessment framework developed by the scientific groups. They agree further that until specific assessment guidance is available, parties should be urged to use the utmost caution and best available guidance to evaluate scientific research proposals to ensure marine environmental protection consistent with the convention protocol. And they agree that given the present state of knowledge, ocean fertilization activities other than legitimate scientific research should not be allowed, and such other activities should be considered as contrary to the aims of the convention protocol. And of course, what precisely constitutes legitimate scientific research remains foggy, very hazy, especially since they haven't fully developed yet an assessment framework for scientific research involving ocean fertilization, and the scientific groups anticipate presenting a final draft for consideration by the governing bodies in October 2010, essentially an assessment guide for ocean fertilization. And then the third kind of thing under IMO, they had a working group trying to develop eight decision options. They actually developed or proposed eight decision options, possible options for further addressing ocean fertilization that came out in February 2009. And these options run from a non-binding kind of approached like a further statement of concern. We're really concerned this time, a second kind of statement of concern, if you will, all the way to a binding standalone article under Annex under the 1996 Protocol or Amendment of Annex 1 to the London Protocol. Australia and New Zealand have actually proposed language possibly where you could have ocean fertilization under the Global Safe List, material or substances for which the principal intention is ocean area fertilization for legitimate scientific research. There's no consensus yet within IMO on the future of which one should be chosen, and again, that will come up for further review next year. Very quickly, I'm running out of time here, I see, but the limited international grip reality is exemplified by the 2009 Aloha Effects experiment. It's a joint iron fertilization experiment carried out earlier this year by the Alfred Wegener Institute for Polar Marine Research and National Institute of Oceanography in India. About 6 tons of dissolved iron were applied to an area of 300 square kilometers. Outside the Antarctic Treaty area, an eddy around this geographical area, and of course, Loha means the Hindi word for iron effects fertilization experiment. And this is where you see it there with that yellow oval just outside the Antarctic Treaty area. And considerable criticisms by environmental NGOs. The alleged was a violation of the CBD's moratorium. Only was supposed to be small-scale scientific research studies in coastal waters. There was no international EIA process, environmental impact assessment process applicable. The project fell outside the Madrid Protocol's EIA provisions. There was a scientific risk assessment conducted by the proponents, AWI and the Institute of Oceanography. On behalf of the Federal Ministry of Education and Science, there were further reviews of the risk assessment, and the risk assessments interpreted the CBD criteria very broadly. They said the project was a spatial small-scale experiment covering just 300 square kilometers compared to 50 million kilometers squared covered by the Antarctic Circumpolar Current. And they said, you know, the project really includes coastal waters here, as coastal plankton species inhabit the offshore fertilized waters. So a very broad interpretation, and it shows you, I think, the limitations of the whole process right now under potential ocean fertilization projects, very limited international control. Because of time here, 49 seconds, counting down left, I'm just going to say a few words about securing compliance. One of the greatest compliance challenges is the failure by many parties to report on the nature and quality or quantity of waste permitted to be dumped at sea, as required by the London Convention and the Protocol. Get this, 33 contracting parties have not submitted reports in the last 5 years. So you're not really getting a clear picture of what's being dumped out there as required by these agreements. And because of time, I'll leave it there. They do have a compliance group, and again, they've had a really rough time getting countries to even report. They even sent out a questionnaire, can you tell us why you're not reporting? And they hardly got any responses back. So you really see the problems of international organizations, in this case, operations under the IMO conventions. Parting thoughts. Ocean dumping in the Southern Ocean from outside the region is not reportedly occurring, and likely for two main reasons: preference by disposers to dispose of waste in areas within national 200 nautical mile zones because of cost savings. If you have dredged wastes, you're not going to bring them to the Antarctic when you can dump it in your home waters. That's a given, okay? And I think the second major reason is hazardous waste export prohibition under the Basel Convention to the Antarctic Treaty area. That really has been the big cutoff, I think, for a lot of potential waste disposals into the Antarctic region. The Madrid Protocol has substantially curtailed the ocean disposal of waste generated within the Antarctic region, with the exception of sewage and domestic liquid waste. And I guess the bottom line then, getting a firm international grip on ocean fertilization proposals remains an unfinished voyage. Stay awake. Be aware in 2010 when you'll have further discussion within the IMO. So there's the unfinished voyage. Thank you. I think I may have set a Smolian record on fastest PowerPoint in history, at least at the conference. Thank you.
So thank you very much, Professor Van der Zak. I would like to, on behalf of the International Board, some gift. This is a medal. Thank you very much.